So the subject tonight is Dharma and the family, and I want to reflect a little bit, largely from the group that we had today, some of the issues around the family. And how Dharma can help. Dharma means spiritual teachings from Buddhism. And I think the first thing to realize, sometimes we're right in the middle of family issues, and they're really big on us, they're really difficult for us. And we can't understand how that can be so difficult. And in some way, the family is the biggest test of our powers, of our insight. Hardly anything bigger than that. And I want to tell you a little story which has been going the rounds of the spiritual groups, about a woman in New York, Jewish lady, that went into a travel agent saying, "I'm desperate to go to India. I want to, there's this name of this place in the Himalayas. I want to go there, get me a ticket now." So the travel agent worked and got her a ticket and so on. She said, "Immediately, I want to go there." And everyone was helping her, assuming she finally saw the light and wanted to go on her spiritual journey, and she was really very keen for this. And she got on the plane and she went to this town, and then she went to the ashram that she was planning to go to, and she knocked on the door and said, "I want to see the guru. I want to see him now." "So, okay, yes, we'll get you an interview. He's actually on retreat right now. He's having his quiet time. No, now. I want to see the guru now." So she said, "Okay, well, we'll see if we can disturb him." Knocked on the door. There's a lady who really wants to see you. She's a spiritual seeker. She's desperate to speak to you. "Oh, okay, okay." So she got an interview with the guru. She knocked at the door and marched in and said, "Jaime, it's enough already. Come home already." And it's really the conditioning inside the family. I mean, Jack Kornfield writes about it in his very well-known book. He spent years in retreat in India, Jack Kornfield. And he wrote a book, a really great book, called The Path with a Heart. And he talks about this at the beginning of the book, that years on retreat in India, and then when he came home back to his mother, he felt everything collapsing, and he was, never mind years of practice. It all goes back somehow to... And I mean, I think that we just have to take this as a real understanding that the family is the place where the conditioning is so strong, it's able to push our buttons all the time, never mind how much we think we are free, our buttons get pushed in the family by the family. And I think we all know, and maybe some of us here who are psychologists know, that we can help everybody else, but our own children turn us into mincemeat, to say in English. And it's basically because the family is the place where the parts of ourselves that we don't want to be exposed are always exposed. The parts of ourselves that are not convenient are always exposed. The family is the best mirror for us. Because when we're with ourselves, we always do the editing. We always do censorship. We always put away the parts we don't like. We bring up the parts we do like. We do sort of a seder, we do some order, and present ourselves to the world through quite a lot of editing and controlling and tidying ourselves up. And in the family, in some way or other, there's a greater truth. We are more, in some way, more true than the world that we, the way we show ourselves to the world usually. Especially our children can know us through and through, and they know the lies. They know the lies that we dress ourselves up, we make ourselves ipur, you know, we make up. And our family is a better mirror because they are part of us, and they are us. And so the family as a mirror is a really important issue to understand, because from there we begin to see why it's so difficult, but from there we can also see what we can do about it. There is in the family a natural struggle, something very, very natural, which is the struggle of a growing identity. Identity's growing, identity's developing, and there is a struggle for freedom and a struggle of control in families, and there has to be. There is in all relationships, and the family relationship is much, much more than any other relationship. This struggle of wanting to be free and autonomous and independent as a self, and wanting to be part of and still part of something, a collection, a collective. So there's a tension there which is always going to be there, and not our fault. And so some of these, the difficulty, we shouldn't blame ourselves, and we often do. It's so difficult, I can't cope with it. I'm trying to be the best father, the best mother, and I still end up fighting with my son or my daughter. I still end up struggling. My daughter, do give her the best love, and she shouts, and she, you know, etc., etc., etc. It's always, and we need to feel, we need to understand the difficulties here, that there's things that are really in the nature of the growing identities, which are struggling against each other and bumping into each other. There's a natural need for selfing. The selfing process is just happening. And it's selfing at the expense of others. Separation is happening. Selfing is happening. It's quite beyond us to really try and control this process. So let's look at some of the ways that the Dharma can help us understand the family a bit more. And the framework for Dharma in daily life is the Eightfold Path. It's the classic teaching of the Buddha, which is especially important in daily life. And if we look at the Eightfold Path, is the Dharma Path in eight parts. And it tells us right away that, for example, we shouldn't raise up meditation as only one or two of the Eightfold Path to the status of, if I don't meditate, I'm nowhere. Because there's six other parts of the path which are all about other things, different things from meditation. So I don't want to go into the Eightfold Path now. There's plenty of opportunity to study it. But I'd like to address two or three aspects of the path. The most important, I think, and the key aspect of the path is the Eightfold Path, the eight sections, is right view. Right view means a view of the world, a understanding of the way the world is working, an understanding of the truth of things, of the nature of things, And from the right view comes practice. And practice creates a view, an understanding of the world. And one of the key features of the right, of the view is somewhat similar to the systemic philosophy of the West, that all things are creating each other constantly, that everything is a dynamic, that nothing in the world is solid and fixed and forever, that everything is constantly in dynamic flow, that every moment is creating the next moment freely, and the next moment is free. The fact that the conditions are the same creates the next moment in the same shape as the previous moment because of conditions. But if you look carefully at reality, it is free. It is constantly in co-creation. That creation is happening constantly. It's a bit like in the Kabbalah, there is this understanding that if God stops his song, even for one moment, the whole world would disappear instantly. It's a bit like that, that the conditions are keep creating the next moment, and if the conditions aren't there, the next moment isn't there. So this sense, this understanding, it sounds philosophical. It's not philosophical. It is an experiential understanding of the way we create each moment by our mind. And inside the family, it leads to an understanding that everything is much more dynamic and much more free. That if the conditions are changing, the dynamic will change. My daughter is actually working as a counselling psychologist in England, and the first technique she learnt in university, technique of counselling, called systemic therapy. Some of you may know about it. But it's just that, that the family is a dynamic, fluid pattern. And if you change the... this sister has been arguing for 10 years with this brother who is under pressure from this father who is, you know, and it's stuck. It seems to be stuck. But if you change the condition slightly, you turn, then the whole thing can reform itself into another shape. And suddenly the sister understands, well, there's no reason for me to argue for 10 years with my brother. It just, I can look at it differently. The whole thing is different. So it's a the family is like a kaleidoscope. You know the word kaleidoscope? You shift it a little bit and everything falls into another colours and whoop, it's all different. And so it's a much more, it leads to a much more important question. Like if you have a perpetual pattern, the families build patterns and the patterns seem to be solid. The pattern of the son is arguing with the father and angry, and there's anger between the son and the father. The pattern of of husband and wife or partners, that one goes in this direction, one goes another direction, and they keep all patterns that keep coming up. If you ask the question, how I respond to the bikoret, the critical flow of constant criticism from my mother, say, how do I respond? Do I defend myself? Do I not defend myself? But ask the question, how can I create conditions that form another system, that the whole system changes? What can I radiate? What can I send out? What vibrations can I send out to change the atmosphere so as to change the pattern? What kind of new conditions can I create? Where's the freedom to create new conditions so that everything suddenly takes another shape? That's the question. Now, often we're so caught into the pattern that we can't be free enough to actually stand back and say, what do I radiate into this pattern? What do I radiate? Mani mshader. We're not free enough to do that. And that's where the right view is important, and that's where the practice is important. Practice tells us that we experience in our spiritual practice that every moment is a new moment. Every breath is a new breath. And if we experience that deeply enough, that changes our view of the world. And our view of the world is a world which is constantly fresh and new, so that we can get out of the patterns, and it's up to every one of us to do it. We can't expect others to do it. We ourselves have to do this work, to be out of the pattern and say, what can I radiate in the family to change, to break the pattern, to change the system, to change the creation of the next moment, knowing it's all free and open. And it's a deeper understanding, but it generates actions and words and a difference. Your son is shouting at you as a father, and the changing pattern might be just a laugh. I don't know, a million possibilities. Just to turn it into a game, just to radiate some peace, or just to give up and say, okay, you be the father, I'll be the son. Don't know. What do you, anything to break it, anything to just create playfully new realities instead of getting stuck in the pattern and feeling helpless. I know one mother whose son is out on the streets, mother in Oxford, hanging out, his 18-year-old boy, hanging out with people sleeping on the streets, doing a lot of drugs, and intelligent boy, and a very sensitive boy, but just completely caught up in that world, in that life of the streets of Oxford. Mm. And it's very similar to the question that Anat asked today about what happens in such a situation. The mother is worried. The worry of the mother, the constantly worrying, sitting up at night, when is he going to come home? Is he going to come home tonight or not? Clearly not. Another night. And when is he says he'll come tomorrow, but he doesn't. I've made a meal, I cooked a meal, and he doesn't turn up, etc., etc. And it's very sad. And both of them are caught in a pattern. And the mother simply cannot stop worrying. And it's something really automatic. Now, you can't ask the mother not to be a mother and say, oh, I don't care. No, I say no. You can't, that's an inhuman thing. But you can ask the mother to actually care, take care for, and begin to take to pieces her worry. Say, right, my worry doesn't actually achieve anything. It's holding the pattern, because my worry is so constant, it's with me morning, in noon and night, and it's driving my son away, but I can't stop it. Because my son doesn't feel like coming home. All he's got is a worried mother. There's no home for him, but I can't stop, because the worry keeps coming all the time. So the boy can't come home. The boy feels the pressure of the mother. He doesn't feel space. The mother doesn't give him space. He doesn't feel relaxed. He doesn't feel he has space to grow because the worry of the mother. He's chosen a life which is not easy. He wants to explore life in this way. I don't mean the mother has to say, do the drugs, it's really fine, go off and so on. I think the mother has a duty to do the best she can to protect the boy. And what we were talking about, Anat and myself in the group today, was to tell the son, yes, there are problems in this particular life you've chosen. If you've chosen this life, it's your choice, but you're coming up with problems. These are the problems, and I have to tell you this. But at the same time, if she could let go, if she could change the atmosphere in the house, an atmosphere of more space and more ease and more freedom in the house, maybe the boy would be less on the streets. Because the conditioning here is important. The atmosphere, the conditioning, the energies, the vibrations in the house are very important. So she, in a way, needs to have more right view to be more of a to dance more with all of this, to be more free in herself. The major work is inside us. The freedom we have to find inside us is we can't blame anybody else. We can't say, well, I would be a better mother if my son wouldn't be da-da-da-da. Or everything would be fine if she da-da-da-da. It's not like that. We take responsibility for what we radiate, what we send out, the vibrations the way the home feels. Each of us has to take responsibility for that. A free mind, a mind with right view, is also a mind that is listening deeply, that is able to listen. Because right view is about not being stuck in labels, identities, positions, views, emdot, views, not being stuck because it's a book you read, that's a very wise book about how to bring up children, not being stuck about any, not allowing yourself to be put in a box, but to see everything constantly as play, constantly as recreating itself, reforming itself. And so your image of the other person, my son, who's the rebel, angry, my mother, who's a worrying mother, the labels you put are blocks to the freedom. So, but only in a sense, with right view, can you begin to challenge the labels you put on each other and on yourself. And part of right view is anicca anatta dukkha, which I won't go into now, but one of the aspects of right view is what in Dharma language you call emptiness. It's being less self-important. It's having less to defend. When I respond with anger to someone that challenges me, I respond from a self that needs to defend itself. Having less to defend is always creating much more freedom. You have less to defend. You don't need to react with defense all the time. There's no need. What's there to defend? You know the story of the empty boat. Do you know the story of the empty boat? The Zen story, quite a nice story, just about this point, that a traveller went to a boatman and said, I want to cross the river. The boatman said, OK, I'll take you across the river. So the boatman and the traveller went on the boat, started to row. Along came another boat down the river and bumped into this boat. And the boatman started to shout and scream at the other boatmen of the other boat that bumped into them. So then they went on a bit more, and another boat came, but there was no one inside. It bumped into them. So the boatman was silent. He didn't say anything. So the passenger said, well, why didn't you shout at this other boat? He said, well, there's no one to shout at. So as much as we are empty, there's no one to shout at. You can shout as much as you like. There's no one there. There's no one there to shout at. You have to be a somebody that wants to defend yourself. It doesn't mean that anyone can kill you and anyone can, you know, yarimita yadayim. I give up. Everyone can do anything they want to me. It doesn't mean that because you're here, but you don't have to keep on defending yourself. You don't have a somebody that's always watching who is attacking. And in families, this is big time. Your defense and attack and the power relations. Remember, it's identities bumping into each other in a family. Trying to be free and yet trying to be connected. And this stress, this pressure, creates a lot of challenges to the self. As much as with right view, you can be empty, transparent, shakuf, because they're empty, then there's nothing to defend. You're just there. You're just there. It can be a bit irritating to live with a Buddhist, I think. You want someone to attack, you know, sometimes probably. Why can't I attack you? But that's beside, you know. The work is really to create the freedom in the family. And right view is one way we do this. The second way is right mindfulness. It's actually what it's in the realm of meditation. Mindfulness, tsumat lev, attention, meditation, awareness. It's building an awareness. And how much struggle inside the family is the result of lack of awareness. Not lack of goodwill, not lack of heart, not lack of... just lack of awareness. Just we don't see. A new word that's come in that's helpful here is emotional intelligence. Like understanding the emotions of somebody else and in the family, why they behave like this. And it's very, very simply, if a child is tired in the evening, can start hitting a parent. Emotional intelligence will see that the tiredness of this child, the stress of the day, feel the child, see what the child's gone through, see in the eyes of the child that the child is just real wild. It doesn't take much. If you don't have the emotional intelligence, you'll not see that. And you'll, the child is angry with me, I'm angry, why you do this? And you already have a conflict. Emotional intelligence is just the understanding of what's behind the actions, moods, etc. And empathy is part of that. That can be learnt. It's not, you say, I don't have emotional intelligence. I was grown up in a, I don't know what, kibbutz, maybe. It can be learned. We can learn it in the meditation cushion if we learn to watch our own heart and mind, if we learn to watch our own breath, our own passing moods, if we learn just to be awake and see the way we are stressed sometimes and things happening inside us, and you know, that gives us emotional intelligence. That is what it is. So it definitely can be learned. Empathy can be learned. It's not something just given from God, or we don't have it. And here it is where our mindfulness, our listening, our power of listening. When we sit and meditate, really what we're doing is listening. With our inner ear. So when we listen deeply to others in the family, somehow things are resolved. A huge amount of problems are just solved by stopping and listening. And doing nothing. And listening is often instead of automatically responding. So at that moment when someone is pressing your button, that mother that is bikoret of your mother or your husband or wife or somebody, at that moment, if we can just stop and instead of responding, listen deeply. What is this person saying with this critical mind that they have? Critical mind is a mind that is suffering. A constant criticism is a mind of pain. It's criticism. It's just an example. Bikoret. It's a painful place where you're actually not dealing with your own pain, but you're projecting it onto somebody else. By bikoret. You should do this, you should do that, you should do this, you should do that, it's better than that. In the name of love sometimes. It's your pain that you're not taking responsibility for, and you're addressing it, you're throwing it onto somebody else with constant flow of criticism. It's not right, it's not... It's basically you saying it's not right. And really, you're saying it to yourself. But you're saying it's not... It's too painful to say it to yourself, so you say it to the nearest person. Your son, your daughter, your mother, your father, you know. So listening, instead of responding, listening to yourself, listening to your own neediness. This is mindfulness. Listening to what you need, to what you're not getting. Listening to your ego coming out. Oh, my ego is coming up big time right now. That's listening. You don't know it unless you listen. And very often it does need real training. Sometimes it needs to have that depth of listening to be able to see and listen to your own ego kind of bursting out, or listen to your neediness, or listen to your own pain so you don't project it out onto the others. It needs work. It doesn't come for free. And sometimes the work isn't easy. It's most difficult work, actually. It's much easier to go off and have a good time and you know, be kind of spiritual. And this kind of listening to yourself isn't easy. But the listening process in the end brings a great reward. It brings a great reward. Because you just stop throwing out your stuff on others, and they stop throwing it back on you. And so listening can shift everything. Actually, the family is a great place of practice, the spiritual practice, because it gives you constant opportunities to see yourself in the mirror, in the places that you don't usually see yourself. And someone said today in the group, well, when I sit quietly, kind of minding my own business, all my old resentments and angers kind of come up. Yes, that's why we sit, to look at ourselves in the mirror. But the family is a place where we can look at ourselves in the mirror, because your son or your daughter is going to show you your blind spots. He's going to show you your difficulties, going to show you your lies, where you covered over, where you covered the difficulties. So it's actually a great place, the family, to see those places in you that you've covered over. But it does need work with those places. Then you really need some tools to actually work with those things. Otherwise, you just, yeah, okay, I know it's difficult, I'm full of shit. And then you get up the next morning and it's the same that happens again. You do need some tools, you do need some ways, and you do need some wisdom. And it doesn't necessarily have to be Dharma. I'm not selling here the only way is the Eightfold Path. But something has to be done to give you the tools of deep listening, especially to those places in you that you're covering up. And that's the mindfulness. That's the aspect of mindfulness. That's the seventh of the Eightfold Path. The awake mind in daily life, in the challenges of daily life. Awake mind towards yourself and empathy towards other. Just to be awake for that. The second of the Eightfold Path is called Right Intention. Right Intention being just direction, just intention. Just to remember your intention. And sometimes it's really needed inside the family situation to remember your intention, because you get lost inside the daily struggle. And the intention here can be, for example, you can intend to watch your children growing up with joy. An intention. You can forget it so easily, but I will intend to do this. And once someone asked a very similar situation to the one I gave you about this mother in Oxford and that I know and her son. And once I was sitting with a spiritual teacher in Kulu Valley in India, Swami Shyam, and someone gave exactly the same story to Swami. And he said something very wise. He said, you need to encourage and appreciate the way that this new being on this planet is struggling to find herself or himself. To really give appreciation to the struggle of this person to find themselves on this planet. They just dropped into the planet. They just dropped into the light. No one asked them. They became the baby. No one asked us whether we want to be born or we don't want to be born. Just arrive. And then we struggle to make sense of it. And if we appreciate the struggle of this kind and have it as a commitment, it's sometimes something we forget, this appreciation of the struggle. Because we only see sometimes the difficulty, the danger, my son is out on the streets and drugs and so on. We see all the difficulties, but we don't appreciate enough. So that's an attitude. And another attitude I think is important. I mean, maybe I'm giving too much advice here, but another attitude that I do think is important is an attitude of not knowing, an attitude of not controlling, an attitude of not needing to control so much. Just now my daughter took her daughter, my granddaughter, to a woman in somewhere in Israel, who seemed to know a lot about developing body in the baby. Now, the baby's 4 months old, and this woman was very aggressive, according to what I heard, very knowing it all, very dominant, and said, you should do this and this. Now, you do this exercise with the baby, and the baby will develop twice as fast of this kind. If you do this exercise, the baby will be more flexible and do splits. What do you call it?
Spagat.
If you do this exercise, like, already at the age of 4, there's a whole agenda. And the trouble, she said, this woman, well, don't you want to... A baby can't be just left alone, stuck there. Don't you want to help the baby to grow? And so there's a muddle here. Of course you want to help the baby to grow, but the question isn't whether you want to help the baby to, you don't want to abandon the baby, but the question is whether you know and whether you have knowledge, whether you have, whether you are controlling with all kinds of adult agendas. And so the ability to stand back and say, we don't know. Let the new life arrive and teach us. We don't know. And I know that most of you here know this. And you're probably not the kind of parents that really need this. But there's a lot of parents that do need this message and really believe that they have to push the child in a certain direction, which is their own ideas, their own concepts. And from the age of 3 months. And an attitude, I think, of not knowing is really helpful to children, because children grow up in the shadow of our pressure. And if we come with the not knowing, I don't know. I'm receiving your message too. My experience is like this. What's yours? I can't say what's best. I can't, you know, this. So I know this is a language that you all know already, but it's important, maybe as an intention, to remember it. Not that we can't, we talked about construction. We have to be so careful of the tendency to keep constructing, building, making structures in ourselves and in the world. Constant, restless building structures. And the education of our children is all about that. And hopefully we'll be very, very delicate about building structure, about constructing our children. Hopefully we'll be very tender and very minimalistic. And children will tell us what they need. So final part of this that I just want to offer is the part of the heart, the compassion. And if we're in a situation that we really can't control, which is mostly all of our life, our natural response is compassion. Compassion is movement of the heart to feel with the heart that life is bigger than us and there is pain in it. It's painful. It's not so easy. To have empathy and compassion. And in situations of the family, really important to have compassion. Compassion flows. Compassion is chemla, is ktat gam chesed kmo simi amra. It's a feeling of being with. Compassion is something which is bigger than just I'm compassionate to you. In the family, it works that we are together in a situation which is bigger than us, or a situation of difficulty which is over us. So, like, if there's a fight inside the family, or one of these patterns, or disputes, or difficulties, the heart, the compassionate heart, would say, we are both caught in a pattern here. It's bigger than both of us. Neither of us are really in control. So let's at least open our heart and feel both of us together in this difficulty. And let our heart open to each other. It's kolel. Compassion is covering all. It's not just my heart for you. Compassion is big. Compassionate heart goes out into the world. Compassionate heart can include all members of the family, including yourself. I need compassion on myself because I'm caught in the same pattern. I'm caught inside this. So I need compassion for me and for the other and for both of us together and for the pattern and for the family and for the country and for the land and for the people and for the insects and the birds in the air. So it's this movement of the heart which is inclusive, and knowing that it's difficult, and it's that understanding which is very helpful inside family situations where sometimes it's beyond us. We can't really control it. We don't want to control it. But there are difficult situations. And so in addition to all the other aspects I mentioned, the mindfulness and the right intention and the right view, compassion is sometimes a beautiful thing. It's not giving up. It's just saying, there are things here that I can't control. There are things here that it's... And let them be. And just let me be with them, with my heart. I have, sometimes we have unavoidable pain that we give to other people in the family. It just happens. Sometimes we can't avoid it. We send our child to school and we feel it's, what have I done to my child? I had that personal experience on my first long visit to India in 1975. I was in India for a year. But I had it all. I was actually working in India, and I was teaching there, and it was all sorted out. But my father died just before I went to India. And it was a really terrible time for my mother for me to go. And she needed support, and I had my ticket, and I had a tafkid. I was at had to be January, the first teaching in university in India. So I remember what happened then. I said to my mother, okay, I have to go. I know it's hard for you. And I feel for us both in this situation. It's painful for me to leave you, and it's painful for you to be left. And I remember feeling compassion. I said, but from this feeling of my heart, I'm going to write to you every week. Every single week, I will write to you. And in fact, within 1 year, every week, I wrote a long... There was no computers at that time. It was couldn't find a... There wasn't a computer or anything. But I would write by hand, long letters. And every week, 4, 5, 6 pages, like she was living my experience in India. And it was beautiful. And I after she died, I found all those letters. And it's like this much. It's a whole book, but it's I don't know why I'm telling this story, to be honest. But it just... I just remember that feeling of compassion, of doing something instead of... I can't avoid hurting my mother. I couldn't avoid it. But the compassion kind of came, and I said, let's together experience my trip in India. Also, by my letters, we'll together go to India, if you like. And so it really helped. So that's always there, compassion for us. And it's always including all of us together. And a healing movement of the heart.